There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away. So it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Hey, this is Tyler.
And this is KC.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
What's happening, all my woods people? It's beginning to feel a little bit like fall in most parts of the U.S. right now.
Winter in some places.
It's winter in some places. Here it feels like fall at 87 degrees or whatever. It is. You know, it's like
nice balmy fall day.
Oh gosh, dude, it has been some kind of humid lately. You know, apparently it rained a lot while I was in Nebraska.
It did.
So it's still in the ground, but it's coming out as the sun heats it up.
Yeah.
It's coming out of the ground.
It's like a back to Eden type thing we got going on here where the mist comes up from the ground and waters the plants, you know? That's what we got going on in East Texas.
Yeah, that's fun, man. I'm ready for like one of those days where it's not, you know, 87 and still muggy. Mm-hmm. It's like 87 and like you're like, ooh, crispy, you know?
Nice. Yeah, I've got some chapstick here laying out, getting packed up for the elk hunt.
Yep.
You don't really have to use chapstick in Texas until maybe like one January day.
Dude,
That's it.
The issue with living here where we live is like you go other places to hunt and you're like, you smile and your lips break in half. You know what I mean? It's like, what
we
is
are not
going
conditioned
on?
To that no. at all.
No, it's bad news. So, yeah, dude, I'm definitely ready for it. I'm appreciative of this like cooler weather, but, you know, I think where we're heading in the next, you know, few days is going to be a much different story. And so I'm a little bit worried.
Dude, Mike Hunsucker has been posting stories and stuff, you know. It looks so cold in Colorado. Dude, right now.
It's like 20 degrees.
I know, snow coming down. Mm. That's good. Okay, couple things, though, for us. That means that water is not going to be an issue. We're going to be able to find water everywhere we go, which might deconcentrate the elk, which I don't think it's been super dry, so it's not that big of a deal. But two, it's going to possibly push elk down out of the high country. And then three, it's going to make, you know, sign pretty readily available if there's still snow on the ground in some places. Mm-hmm. You know, like if there's tracks in that snow, we know those elk have been in there within the past week.
Yeah, and if there's tracks that are that were produced in muddy areas, you know, that's because the snow melted or whatever, and it's been in the past few days. So
I think it sets up good for us because it seems like to me everybody loves cold fronts, weather fronts, all that kind of stuff for hunting, but really the backside of it's where it's at.
Mm.
You know, like when the snow's coming down, think about Iowa last year. Mm-hmm. When the snow was coming down the first day, we didn't have a great hunt.
Mm-mm.
But the next day,
Rage.
Yeah, it was going down. So I think that that sits up well for us. And speaking of that, guys, we are leaving Sunday to go on a Colorado elk hunt. So keep us in your prayers and be patient with us if you send us a message or something in that time. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. And also, if you make any purchases of our brand new Let's Go Scouting t-shirts.
I'm wearing it.
Todd's repping right now. Yep. But I don't know if I can wear a shirt that has my own face on it. I'm just very – people probably can't tell
it's me. If you
wear
it in comedy, you know,
yeah,
then it's good. But that's if you true. Wear it in –
Seriousness,
yeah, it's not good. So.
But anyways, those new shirts are out. If y'all like them, go make a purchase and support us. We really appreciate that. But like we said, we'll be out of pocket for about a week or a little more, so we'll get all that stuff taken care of when we get back. But speaking of getting back, you just got back from Brasker.
Brasker, yeah. And so people don't know like the rest of the story, I guess.
Paul Harvey.
The rest of the story. My voice is probably sounding a little bit like Paul this morning. I was at the volleyball game last night, and so I was yelling. So
yeah.
I'm trying to be supportive.
It's good.
We have the quietest fan base on earth, mm-hmm. so I want to be an example that you good. Can yell and people won't judge you. Yeah. And even if they do, it doesn't matter. So
see, you know. I never really thought that Reigns was that quiet. I just always felt like people yelled the wrong things.
You ever been to a volleyball game?
I have. they're never like encourage the girls. They always just rag on the refs.
Oh, you know what else they do is they when you say they never encourage the girls, the only time they ever say anything to the girls is when it's like we're 10-0 mm-hmm. and we've been dominating every game, and then all of a sudden we play a little bit of competition. It's like a close game. It's like, come on now.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, that doesn't help now.
No, it doesn't.
Don't do that.
That's why I like football, man. When when we played ball, you really couldn't hear the stance.
I never have heard anybody.
No, except my mom was always like, I yelled for you the whole time. I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, never heard
it's
you.
It's dead quiet out there. Sorry. Yeah,
you it's know? Like focus. You know, and I'm sure the girls are that way for the most part too, but mm-hmm. I try to be very loud. Because I don't know, man, like they're so good, and I just want to make sure that they, you know, have a little bit of hype.
Yeah.
You know, like hype's a big deal, man.
Oh yeah.
So,
and it helps in those, stadium sports or whatever. What do you call that? Gym sports?
Gym sports.
So, yeah.
Sure.
You know, like basketball.
Indoor.
Yeah. Indoor stuff. There's like that, that energy.
Echo and everything else. Yeah. The energy is like right there. It's mm-hmm. close. So I don't know. Trying to hopefully inspire others to do the same, but like, Either way, I'm trying to be loud and like, mm-hmm. I don't know, man. I played in some stadiums that had some pretty rowdy fans, Texas Tech being one of them.
Yeah.
And I know a bunch of dudes are raising their pistols up right now, you know, but like, that was not a fun atmosphere, man. You know,
if they you had are nets. Raising your pistols up, this new shirt's red and black.
Oh,
so, I
yeah.
mean, come on.
Yeah. Dude, and speaking of hype, like, this is the ultimate hype
that
moment,
is hype.
Right?
It is hype
like,
right there.
It captures the hype moment. So, but yeah, anyway, I was, excuse the voice, but I did have a couple extra days there in Nebraska after we talked about the last encounter. And to be succinct and short and sweet here, it really not a whole lot happened outside of me being on a consistent and constant Map Scout challenge.
Yeah.
Real world Map Scout challenge. So I pretty much, Jack and I, we didn't see that buck the next morning. We actually didn't see a deer the next morning, period, on that property. And so it was like, you know, we were like, well, I guess we blew it out. There's a chance I stay there and I see that buck and I get a chance to go back in on him and kill him. But just it's one of those things. It's like Mexican food. You go to a Mexican food place. There's 99 items. They all have beef, tortillas, and hot sauce and cheese. You know what I mean? It's like really the variations are just a little bit different.
And that's kind of like my dad says about Taco Bell. He says, just order soft or crunchy. That's the only difference. It all tastes the same.
That's for real. Like, you know, and we've been, when I toured, you know, we'd go to Mexican food a lot. And, dude, literally there was like 100 menu items. And I'm like, well, what's the difference here?
Yeah.
We'd be sitting around for like 20 minutes waiting on somebody to make a decision. And I'm like, do you understand what's going on here? So, anyway, my point is, the analogy is that Nebraska, you have the whole state to go to. So, it's like, you know, do you focus on something or do you go somewhere else? You know, mm-hmm. So we went somewhere else. I knew where I hunted last year. I've talked about it before. We ended up there.
It was like, and this was the what would you call this? Like the last ditch effort, right? Like the home stretch, like going all
last
in,
evening.
Going all in on the hunt.
We thought last evening, let's go to a place where we know there's a lot of deer. And we walked a mile in and I had been looking on the maps and it's super dry out there, mm-hmm. and we were, I mean, most most ponds, most tanks didn't have water in them. And so I actually talked about that with Spencer yesterday on the Rut Fresh stuff. So, but I mean, most of these ponds were dried up. I mean, honestly, like, I think I saw like two or three ponds the whole time that weren't dried. And so my point is, I looked in the maps and I see this real clear one and I'm like, ooh, I bet that's spring fed. It's about a mile in. I know this place holds a lot of deer. This is going to be good. We're going to kill a deer. So we walk in. It's hot, man. It's like 93 or something like that. We walk a mile in, which, you know, young Jack is not used to this. So I have to kind of ease him into this stuff. But he kept up, you know, he was able to ride on my back for a few miles.
Those cowboy boots on?
Yeah. So anyway, we get to the pond. It's got water in it. It's clear. There's tons of tracks around it. And so kind of do a quick scout around the pond without making a bunch of noise. We spooked like two does right off the edge of the pond when we got there. And then there was like three on the other side of the tank, like 100 yards that never saw us. And they, the whole afternoon, they were like walking back and forth and running back and forth. I don't know what they were doing, chasing each other, getting rid of flies or something. Yeah. But anyway, we ended up picking a spot and I was like, I hope this is the spot, you know. And it ended up being the spot because this tank was pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up sitting there all afternoon. We sit on the ground because there's not really any, there's one tree that's decent, but it's kind of an old and short cottonwood and the limbs like come down super low. So, yeah. I mean,
stunted growth kind
of. Yeah. And so like shooting without having to cut a bunch of limbs and stuff was going to be pretty much impossible. So we sat on the ground in this brush stuff and it was actually a pretty good setup. The hardest part was as a right-hander getting a shot at where they were coming at or coming out. But we probably saw 15 to 20 deer total, maybe 15. And I bet, you know, I don't know, I may be wrong, but like I bet 70% of them came within 25 yards of us.
Did they all come to drink?
They didn't all come to drink because there was a few. What would happen is we were really cutting it close with our wind. And so my idea was like, if it's a buck, I'm just going to hope he gets there, you know, and shoot him before he gets to my wind. But where we ended up having to blow our wind, they would come in and they would get to 25 yards or 20-ish yards, and then they would catch our wind. And like the younger deer would just kind of mill around. And like we had a young doe, she ended up coming in and drinking despite the wind, you know. But like an older doe with two fawns, she didn't like it. She stood there for a couple minutes and then she blew out, you know, and everything. So that's kind of what happened. But like we had one buck come in and it looked just like Anthony's deer from last year. If you haven't seen that video, go check it out. It was a fun little video, from Nebraska last year. It's in the season playlist. But yeah, so that was the only buck we saw. He ended up at 20 yards and, you know, could have smoked him, but I just decided I didn't want to really, you know, it was hot, dude. And we're a mile back.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to deal with bugs and cleaning a deer and all this stuff, have to go a mile back to get the cart, drive or walk a mile in with the cart, take this deer out. Pretty rugged country.
Do you have to take them out whole in Nebraska?
You know, that's a good question, but we were going to take them out whole.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we brought the pack in case of a certain situation. I was going to actually look up that rule to make sure, but if it was worked out better for us to just pack them out, then, you know, I was going to do that if it was legal. So, but that's a pretty cool rule that some states have where you can't quarter up your deer.
Yeah. Really, guys? Man. Well, I guess it was just, it's worth the off chance. Well, let me start a different way. We're going to South Dakota pretty much as soon as we get back from Colorado.
Yep.
And if we tag out in a couple days, it's worth you hanging on to your tag to go maybe a stop for day and a half.
We talked about that. Yeah. And I mean, there's a chance that buck is still in that hole where we had him at 12 yards, you know, so
there's also a chance that, we're traveling through other parts of the state on the way to South Dakota and we're like, ooh, okay.
Yeah. Let's stop for a second. Or like, oh, there's one right there.
Yes, exactly.
Can we make a stop? Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the hunt was a very tough hunt. The corn was, pretty much holding and hiding the deer the whole trip, I feel like. And so hopefully it'll be out by the time, you know, we're coming back from South Dakota, or some of it, and we'll get a chance to see a little more country and see more deer.
You know, that corn thing, was kind of perplexing to me. We talked a lot about this in the last podcast, but I didn't really think deep into the fact that it was so dry in Nebraska, and that might be like the only good source of moisture. You know, they can eat corn and not really have to drink that much.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why they were so hard in the cornfields during the day.
Well, and also with there being so much shade in there and pivots on those corn, on that those cornfields, like they're getting water from those, you know, that's holding in some of those low spots in those cornfields from those pivots. So I think they had everything they needed there, man, except for just wind, you know, if they needed to get away from bugs or something. But in like a monoculture like that, like, I wonder how many bugs are actually in the corn anyway, you know? I mean, I would think that possibly that monoculture only is a good habitat for certain types of bugs or something, you know? I don't know. But just thinking about it, you know, it definitely held the deer. So,
yeah.
Anyway, you know, that video, there's actually, I'm going to have two videos from that series, the one with the big buck and then just kind of the rest of the trip and some cool footage of just, you know, deer and strategy and stuff like that. So that one will be much shorter, but hopefully, I'm thinking, we haven't really talked about this, but probably while we're on the elk trip, that first Nebraska video will come out. So definitely go check that out and subscribe if you haven't. Also, subscribe to the podcast.
Hey, you know,
if you haven't, if you're listening for the first time and you like Bill Winky, we have Bill on about quarterly. So we like that guy.
He's
too.
Hard to beat, man.
Yeah, he's a very knowledgeable dude, very humble. And so with that, I guess we will just go straight into this conversation and hear some good tactic from our friend Bill. All right, now on the phone is Bill Winky with Midwest Whitetail. Bill, have you been doing any fishing this summer?
Well, the summer's been really busy. Our son bought a house up in the college town where he's at, so I've been helping him with some renovations on it, and we've been moving, and gosh, it's been one of those years. Then you throw, I mean, we were really planning on going up into Canada, and with the coronavirus, they still haven't opened up that border, so we didn't make that trip. So it's just been a kind of an off year, you know, a lot of busy work and then some disappointments, you know, with that stupid virus.
Yeah.
But yeah, unfortunately, how about you?
Very little, really. KC, same boat.
I haven't even left the state. So we had a son in March, and which is a great blessing, of course, but really limits your travel. So for at least the year 2020, we're gonna stick around close to home, and which probably isn't a bad thing to do anyways.
I went to New Mexico during June, and just fishing the streams there, which, like, finding a big stream in New Mexico is kind of tough sometimes. So it was mostly just small to medium stuff, and we had a good time. I took my son and taught him how to kind of circle cast a fly rod, and I think he caught like three browns or something like that, kind of small ones, you know, but it was a good time. Outside of that, man, it's been pretty much just busy for us. We kind of undertook a big whitetail map scouting project this year, and this summer has been pretty much just editing for me is all it's been.
Okay.
I'm sure you know how fun that is.
Yeah, it can be pretty tedious.
Yes, and it has been. So, anyway, you have some big news that was kind of shocking to me that I found out in the email. I guess you're okay with us talking about the farm a little bit, huh?
Yeah, yep, go ahead. It's not a secret.
Okay, so you have sold the farm. I would have never guessed you would have done such a thing.
Man.
Well, and it was, of course, a really good farm. I put it together piece by piece with eight different transactions. So it started out pretty small, and then my neighbors would come to me or I'd bump into them. And, you know, I bought, you know, several of my neighbors' properties and put it together over time. So I had a lot of, you know, personal attachment to it, as you might expect. You know, my parents are getting older. They're getting up in that age where, you know, they need a lot more, I won't say attention, but, you know, I see that as, you know, they're not going to be around forever. So I don't want to be as far away from them as I have been, as far away from my family. And, you know, where we were at there, we didn't have family close, and both of our kids graduated from high school and were more or less on their own. And like I said, you know, our son even has his own place now. So, it made sense timing wise to move closer to my parents. That's the basic reason for it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with where we were at, and the farm is good. And, you know, we had a lot of memories there, living there for as long as we did, you know, raising our family. So that was hard. It was hard. It was harder on the home side than it was on the farm side, believe it or not.
I do.
Because you'll find that out too. Yeah. You have so many memories, you know, this happened here and that happened there, you know, and it's just, that's the hard part.
Yeah.
But, you know, from the, just being able to replace that farm someplace else has been a challenge. So I'm kind of still looking, you know, still trying to find that, you know, ideal piece of land back up closer to mom and dad. So I've got a lease there. I'll be hunting some permission ground, and there's a bunch of public land in that area too. So I'm just going to hunt different types of properties and, you know, keep my eyes open for something that really grabs my attention, you know, from a purchase standpoint.
Sure.
But, yeah, I just figured if I'm going to be spending so much time every year in the field, you know, and why don't I just, you know, find something closer to them so that, you know, I can see them more often.
Yeah. Does that mean that in the year 2020, you're going to have one less archery tag than you usually do?
Yeah, that's right.
Really?
Yeah. Unless I buy something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been, that was a little bit of an eye opener when I got about halfway through this process. I'm like, gosh, I haven't found anything to buy yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dang, I'm not going to have that.
Be selective.
Maybe you'll see me on the trout stream halfway through November when I'm trying to figure out what to do with my time.
Yeah, exactly. Looking for the fall run.
Yeah. You know, I would say it's been a hard decision, but, you know, we're coming to terms with it. You know, I think the kids found it kind of hard too, you know, especially our son, because, you know, he was, I think, a year old maybe when we moved there.
Wow.
And, you know, all of his friends, all of his memories, everything, you know, revolved around that place. So, you know, when we just say, well, we're going to sell it, he just looked at us with like a blank expression. Oh, no, you're not. So,
yeah. You could have told him, hey, man, you can buy it if you want to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That might be a little while for that thought. Yeah.
Yeah. Is he a Hawkeye or Cyclone, or what's he doing?
He'd be a Cyclone, and our daughter's a Hawkeye.
Oh, house divided, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're both good schools.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, I'm a loyal Iowa person, so I don't care what school you go to in Iowa, I'm gonna cheer for you.
Yeah, that's
unless
cool.
You're playing, you know, if they're playing each other, I think it's a little bit tougher, but
yeah. So what are you looking for in a property? Are you looking for something similar to what you had, or are you gonna mix it up a little bit?
No, I think what I want there, I grew up in Almaquis County, which is the far northeast corner of Iowa,
mm-hmm.
and that's the bluff country. You know, and I'm four generations deep on both sides of my family up there. And, you know, so I know so many people, and I've hunted everywhere up there. And even one of my summer jobs for a couple of years was mowing the road shoulders for the county, you know. And so I know every corner of the county inside and out, either trout fishing or deer hunting. When we left there and moved to southern Iowa originally, I had permission on 64 different farms for whitetail hunting.
Mm.
So, you know, so I knew like every little back corner. So my problem now is that I know too much. You know, so I go up there, you know, and you'll see a nice farm for sale, and it's like, yeah, it's a pretty nice looking farm, but I know where there's some really, really cool ones, you know? So, you know, you're always sitting there thinking, well, maybe if I wait, you know, I'll one of these other ones, I can talk somebody into selling. And I came really close on two. I had two of them I thought, you know, I had in the bag, but you know, the owners, they didn't have to sell, you know, and they weren't really for sale. And then towards the middle of the discussions, they just said, nah, you know, we've talked it over again, and we're just, you know, we're too attached. You know, we're not going to sell. But that can change. You know, as soon as people know you're looking, then people will start coming to you and you know, and saying, well, I've got something here that you might be interested in. So I expect, you know, that even if I don't push quite as hard, which, you know, I probably will continue to, but I just want something really pretty. I want something in the bluffs that's just, you know, you go there and you feel like, you know, I just have my cabin up here in the hills, and I'm just going to sit back and just relax and look down the valley, and, you know, just more on the pretty side. And, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of it up there that's like that. That's really bluffy and pretty and, you know, big hardwood timbered ridges and trout streams running through it and stuff like that. So, I'm kind of holding out for that perfect piece.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I mean, they're there. I mean, I know which ones they are. I mean, I know all the people who own them and you know, like going, you know, I talk to them on the phone. It's like, or knock on their door. It's like, hey, will you sell me this? And they're like, ah, nah. Yeah. So it's hard to buy something that's not for sale.
Yeah.
But you know, I know which farms I want or which properties I want, you know, at least, you know, a collection of maybe there's 40 of them up there that I would buy or more, but you know, so far I haven't been able to get any of them to actually sell.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was at. I actually bought my first, I guess you could say rec property. I guess it was May that we closed on it. So I haven't had it that long. It's a much smaller, you know, 30 acres, but, it was one of those deals where like we were about to build a house. We were like 4 days from closing on a construction loan to build on, the lot that I had and had, you know, same thing. I'd been putting feelers out and ended up, kind of just through the grapevine ended up, you know, this guy didn't want to sell it to me earlier in the year and, or about a year and a half ago. And I found out he was possibly wanting to sell it. And so, you know, just came about it, but it was kind of, I'm in the same boat. Like I didn't just want to buy anything out there that was, you know, 20, 30 acres,
right.
Because I grew up around here and I know that, there are areas, that are very, I mean, there's very much pockets of decent bucks. Mm-hmm. There's pockets of lots of deer with little, maybe, I don't know how you would say this, but like little smaller genetics, maybe, you know, overall, or just the ability to grow bigger doesn't seem to happen there. And then there's just places that deer just hardly ever live, you know? And so it's a good and bad thing. Cause it makes you, you know, you take your time and you may have to, it's maybe years before you get to do what you want, but you also end up hopefully getting something that'll last you a long time and you'll be satisfied with. So,
yeah, but I think that's it. You know, it's sort of like my situation. If I didn't know as much as I knew and as many people as I knew, I probably would have bought something, you know, I would have just bought something that was for sale, you know, but I knew that like, I don't know if I want to be in that neighborhood. I'm not sure about that neighbor. You know, I know that family and there's a little bit of history there, you know, and sort of like, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of, you see the warning flags. Whereas if you just came in there blind, you'd say, oh, that's a cool piece of land and snap it up. And, and it wasn't even a matter of price really. I'm not saying that I didn't have an unlimited price. I certainly do. But, I just couldn't get them to sell, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the thing. We'll just wait and see. I'll play it out, but, I'll have places to go. But like you said, I'm going to be one tag short unless I shouldn't say that. The house that we bought, up here north of Iowa City has 13 acres on it.
Oh,
and I could get my landowner tag and hunt the 13 acres right below the house here. But
yeah.
Well, that's the only thing we own right now.
13 acres in Iowa is probably not a terrible thing. So that could make for a pretty cool story.
We'll have to put the whole 13 acres in the corn if I'm going to have any success here.
Yeah, there you go.
That's funny.
Are you planning, like whenever you're looking for the property, are you looking for that, you know, the beautiful place and expecting that you can grow the type of bucks that you want to shoot there? Or are you looking for, you know, certain regions, since you know the area so much, that you know are going to be, you know, perennially a place where big deer live?
It's both, really. And again, that's where, I won't say the problem lies, but, you know, I know all the people. Mm-hmm. And so I can track down the history of, you know, what they're shooting and what their management practices are without even going up and talking to them, because I know a person who knows them. I mean, I'm like one, you know, what do they call that? You know, where you're a point of contact or whatever. I'm one layer away from just about everybody in that county.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm either related to them or related to their neighbor, you know?
Yeah.
So, so that part of it, I feel like I want to make sure I've got good neighbors first, but then I want to be in a really pretty spot that's a little bit remote second. And, it's doable. Like I said, I spent hundreds of hours, you know, studying, the plat books and stuff like that, targeting specific farms, saying, okay, this would be a good one. And I know the guy who owns it. Let me call him. Let me talk to, you know, his neighbor. Let me, you know, put my feelers out. So I did investigate probably as many as 20 of the 40 that I had identified, and just came up, you know, with almost twice. But you're right. That's what I'm looking for, is the best of both. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like the public land is so pretty up there too. You know, it's just, it's really pretty. I mean, yeah. You're on the Mississippi River bluffs overlooking the river, you know, and I grew up hunting ducks, you know, up in there on the river bottoms, and there's big whitetails out on the river bottom. You know, I mean, there's places where you can go that's just gorgeous, get away from people where you don't have to even buy anything. But, you know, my choice would be to buy something. But in the meantime, you know, I've got options.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that Bill does a great job of is starting out his season sometime in late July, early August, and figuring out where his target bucks are.
Yeah.
And he uses a lot of different habitat features and then also some baiting to set trail camera traps to figure out where these bucks are. Well, if you're on public land, the baiting thing's not an option, but you can still figure out where the places are to target these bucks. And actually, guys, The Element, Tyler and KC have done a little bit of stuff to maybe help you do that. So we have two different video series that have came out recently. The Map Scout Challenge, which y'all have heard of. And then the new one for us is the Public Land Hotspots, which is, I mean, if you wanted to boil it down, the Public Land Hotspots is like a very condensed version of Map Scout Challenge, mm-hmm. right? It's, we get on the maps, we get on Onyx Maps, we show you the stuff on the phone, how we're like breaking this down mentally and kind of show you the different places that you can find by map scouting to go and find a target buck.
Yeah, and you know, like in Nebraska this past week, Onyx was like a huge part of the game. I mean, I honestly, because of the fact that we couldn't find deer because of the corn and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. like we talked about, I spent 6 days on Onyx. Mm-hmm. Like it was ridiculous, you know, how much I was thinking, man, my date is almost over and this is like September 3rd, you know, for the month. So it was like, you know, it was difficult, but it was like a Map Scout challenge every day. And I was mm-hmm. trying to put those habitat features together, the things that we talk about, fence crossings, feeder creek crossings, looking at trails in the aerial and that kind of thing, and trying to make all this work and make sense on the map. And so what we've tried to do is, like we've said, we're not experts, but we try hard to show our experience and the things that we have learned, or the things that we look for at least on public land when we first start map scouting. So check those series out. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube, and let's get back to Bill. I have to reach back and kind of emphasize a point you made earlier. When you were talking about how hard it was to sell the home on the property, you know, and I had a house, and this was just a little half acre lot and a house. But I brought both my babies back home to that house and had it for 7 years, and sold that a couple of years back. And I admit mm-hmm. I've walked around in the house and bawled my eyes out. mm-hmm. It was a difficult thing to do, to leave that house, just because all the memories, like you said, and you know, those, you've got memories there. You've got memories, all across that place that you had. And a lot of that is going to be, in relation to deer as well. And so, you know, one thing we kind of want to talk about today, was the annual patterns of deer and just, the history that you may have with particular bucks. And I know that's been a big deal for you. And we enjoy watching it, on the show as well. Just you being able to say, you know, I think we talked to you last year for one of our big buck breakdowns about a deer that was kind of a surprise buck, but I think you mm-hmm. had seen it the year before in the same area. Is that right?
Yeah. I had a couple of years of history with that deer, but the year before he showed up one morning a few hundred yards away from where I ended up killing him. Mm-hmm. But that deer, some deer are pretty easy to find anytime you want to find them, and some of them aren't quite as easy. And it has to do with their ranges and you know, their shifts and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So that he was one that I didn't find back again in 2019.
Oh yeah.
I didn't see him in 2019 at all until the day he walked out in front of the blind. So,
how does that date match up with, like when you've seen him before? Like, was he in the area in the same date range, or why do you think he was there?
I don't know. I think he shifted a little bit, because I could find him anytime I wanted to in 2018 and in 2017 also. And he had shifted he moved apparently, because even with, you know, running corn in front of the camera, you know, in September, which is my typical way of trying to find back the bucks after they shift, you know, from their summer to their fall ranges. And I run partway into October and, you know, I avoid all of the baiting rules and so forth. I've talked to the local game warden about what I need to do, you know, to not violate any baiting rules, but I'm pretty aggressive on trying to find them. And I feel like I can, if they're there, that I'll get pictures of them. And he wasn't there. So my assumption is that he moved his core off the farm. And I don't know exactly where, but he fringed. He apparently was fringing back. You know, I caught him, you know, I caught him on one of those times when he was just circling back through, apparently. Kind of weird. Yeah, it's every deer is different. You know, we've talked about that, I'm sure, but people want to stereotype these things and say, well, this is what deer do. But what they're, you can only generalize and you can say, this is what deer mostly do. But, you know, each deer has their own way.
Yeah.
You know, they're, you won't call it a personality, you know, but you can call it their behavior or their characteristics are unique. And, I think that's what makes it fascinating, is because you go into it and they're not robots. They're not programmable. You know, you have to take each one as he comes and, try to figure out what's going on with that specific deer. If we didn't have trail cameras, we wouldn't be able to do it. And, you know, some people think that trail cameras are, you know, a crime, that we shouldn't have them and it's not fair. But to me, what it does is it deepens the satisfaction of the hunt, because then you get to do those things.
How old was that deer when he showed back up? Or when
I think he was only four. I mean,
okay.
I'd like to think he was five, but I'm afraid that he was only four. It was, if he would have been on there religiously and he'd have been on the camera on the farm and I knew that he was there, I think I'd have let him go. I'm not 100% sure, because I wasn't going to sell the farm at that point. You know, I mean, that's a whole different story about how that happened. It wasn't for sale. You know, it wasn't like we were listing the farm or anything like that. It's just a realtor brought me a buyer and said, hey, would you be interested in selling? And I said, well, at some point we're going to, you know, and the best time to sell is when there's somebody that's sitting there with cash, you know.
So, yes.
You know, I wasn't planning on selling it. So it's not like I was trying to clean out, you know, the best deer, you know, before I moved on. I seriously considered letting the deer go, but then it crossed my mind. It's like, dang, this deer is barely on this place. You know, this is the first time I've gotten any sign of him in almost a year. It would be a mistake, right now to let him go. If he was regular, you know, if he'd have been a deer that I felt like was living on the farm, I probably would have let him go, because he could have, he had the potential to be a 200-inch typical.
Oh my goodness.
He was gigantic. He was over 180 as a 4-year-old, and that was with one of his G4s was kind of stunted, but he had like 10, 11-inch brow tines.
Oh,
I mean, you can, the scores rack up fast when the brow tines are 10 or 11 inches long.
Yes, they do. Wow.
Yeah. That's a measurement you don't always get, man. That's awesome.
That's right.
Dude.
So anyway, that's the story on that deer, but he was a surprise. Usually we have a pretty good idea what's going on, you know, as far as where certain deer are and where they're probably killable. But, that guy just kind of came out of the blue, which that was a lot of fun, of course, you know, when that happened. Sometimes I think, you know, if you follow them too close, you know, maybe you take a little bit of the excitement, maybe not the excitement, but the surprise, that adrenaline rush, you know, some of that kind of gets, you know, we just spend so much time, you know, on one deer, that some of that surprise part of it gets lost. And I do think that's fun to capture that once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. You may get to experience a little less of that close following this year.
Yeah, there'll be a lot more surprises in the next bit of hunting I do here. It's like, hey, there's deer here.
Yeah, that's a good YouTube title optimization, though. You know, like, you can put surprise buck in every YouTube title this year.
Yeah, every single day is going to be another surprise buck.
Yeah. Oh, so are you seeing, like, when you see a deer shift his home range, you know, not necessarily in a seasonal aspect, but like this deer was on you, mm-hmm. you felt like the first couple of years you noticed him and then off of you. Like, is there a certain age that a buck tends to do that at, that you've seen?
Not to my knowledge. I think some of them, It just sort of, I won't say random, it's random to us, but I don't think, you know, I don't think there's a, excuse me, a definite timetable to that. I talked with Mark Drury about this one time, and Mark's a lot smarter about this maybe than what people think, you know, and he's got a good reputation, but Mark might be one of the savviest deer hunters in the whole country when it comes to just understanding what deer do. And this was way back. I mean, it's probably 10 years ago or more. And he said that they felt like about 30% of their bucks relocated their core, you know, from each year. So like, you know, the same one doesn't relocate, you know, over and over and over, but if you take all the bucks across the spectrum on the properties that they were watching, 30% of them would be relocated the next year. So it was, that was his number. And I don't know for sure, you know, based on my experience, if I agree or disagree with that number, because I haven't tried to add it up, but he actually spent time actually putting numbers to it. And he felt like, you know, just under a third of the bucks would relocate their core, you know, whether they relocated it off the property or just to a different part of the property. That, you know, that's a different, you know, question. But, so I think that's, you know, at least a reasonable starting point to say that that many of them or, you know, a decent number of them actually do relocate slightly from year to year. And that affects a lot of stuff, of course, when it comes to hunting them. The ones that I like are the ones whose cores stay where they're at and they continue, their ranges continue to shrink as they get older and they become more daylight active within those ranges. I mean, we run into those kind of deer once in a while and they're super easy to kill. And they're usually older deer. Sometimes they can be really, really, you know, big antlered deer too. I've had deer like that over the years that every year they got easier to kill because their range shrunk and they were more daylight active within that range. So it's like any given day you could go find them because you know right where they're going to be and they're going to be walking around during the day. But that's pretty rare, especially in areas that get very much hunting pressure. You know, they just don't really last that long. I'm not saying that, I mean, deer do adapt to pressure, but what I think more than that is the ones who exhibit that type of behavior get killed. You know, so they don't get a chance to live to be 5 or 6 or 7 years old and be daylight active. If they're daylight active as a 2 or 3 year old, they're going to get killed. So that's, you know, I think there's two sides to that. I think people make them nocturnal, but I think the ones that survive are the ones that are naturally inclined to be nocturnal.
That buck from last year, you know, I know your hypothesis now is, you know, a shifting home range. But in the past, you've talked about just as bucks mature, their home range just kind of shrinks a little bit. Do you think that could have been the case too, to where that deer, his core area wasn't on your property, but for, you know, the first 2 or 3 years of his life, he was running willy nilly all over the place, and then, you know, in year four, he just kind of shrunk that home range, and you just happened to catch him on your place the one day he made a little vector out of. You know, out of his normal area.
I think it's possible, but normally what we see is, cause he, if he was 4, like I suspect, I mean, he could have been 5, but he would have had to been an awfully big, no, I think he was 4. So anyway, I'm not going to excuse myself on that one, but if he was only 4, that's usually before that home range shrinking starts to take place. I mean, I usually see that around, you know, like 6.
Gotcha.
Even at 5, they tend to keep their ranges pretty good size. And then 6, 7, 8, they live that long. You know, 6 is almost like the magic switch that gets flipped, you know, and from what I've seen. And I asked Mark about it too, you know, and I bounce a lot of ideas off him whenever I see him. But it seems like at that age, something happens to them physiologically and they just aren't the same animal anymore. They aren't nearly as cautious and their ranges are tend to be smaller and they just become a lot easier to kill, you know? So the challenge is, you know, that people look at saying, oh boy, these guys must really know something. They're able to kill these great big deer. Well, the reality of it is that those deer get to be that age, you know, and we're hunting places where the deer reach that age and they don't become harder to kill. Like people think. They get easier. And you know, so people talk about that smart old buck. They might be talking about a 4-year-old. You know, they're not talking about a 6 or a 7-year-old. You know, they're not smart. They really aren't. You know, I mean, I know it sounds bad.
Yeah.
They stay alive because they're nocturnal. Mm-hmm. You know, and as soon as they're not nocturnal anymore, they're like, man, this deer is pretty easy.
Yeah. 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 I'm still waiting on some of those bucks to show up for me.
Yeah. Well, it's just, you got to hunt places where they get old. That's the thing, you know, and people, you know, I don't pick any, you know, or pull any bones about that. It's like, you know, I think I'm a decent whitetail hunter and make good decisions, you know, typically, but I hunt places where the deer are, you know, where those bucks exist.
That's fun.
And it's really hard to, that's it. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd rather, I can promise you, KC can attest to this. If it's like 8:30 and we hadn't seen hardly any deer, like I'm ready to eat a Pop-Tart and get out of the stand. You know what I mean? Like I like seeing deer, you know, so that sounds fun to me. Yep. So do you have like a, when you have history with a deer and you want to go find that deer back, do you have a method to the way you place trail cameras in regards to that?
Yeah. I mean, for me, since again in Iowa, it's legal to run a camera in front of bait. I tend to fringe what I think are the various core areas on the property. So like if I look at it and say, here's a block of timber, there's probably, you know, there's got to be some bucks living in there. I don't go in there. You know, I'll find the places on the fringe of that where I could put a camera and you know, a little small pile of corn in front of it and just try to pick off, you know, whatever's coming out of there. So, you know, I break the farm down into a lot of different, you know, quote unquote cores. Like maybe every single ridge, wooded ridge, would be a potential core, you know, for a buck. So I don't look at it from the standpoint of saying, well, you know, I have to have a camera for every 20 acres or, you know, whatever the, you know, some magic formula. It has more to do with just the way that the land lays and the way that I feel like the deer use it. Then I try to figure out, okay, is he in this area, which is a potential core? You know, is he over here, you know, which is a different potential core? Because there's certain places they won't live, you know, so why bother even messing with it? And there's certain places where, you know, that they spend a lot of time, you know, they bed on ridges and, you know, there's certain, you can identify areas pretty quickly where, you know, a deer can possibly have moved to. And then I just fringe those areas. I mean, I like being able to get in and out, even if the deer know that I'm there, without impacting. So that means I've got to stick with fringes, you know, where I could drive a tractor or I can drive a truck, you know, right up to the edge, step out, you know, check my card, change, you know, whatever, and then move on. And the deer go, it's just, you know, it's just Bill out checking his food plots. You know, I mean, they aren't offended by me doing that. So those are the locations that I pick. And I have, you know, probably 25, 30 camera locations, you know, on that farm that I use pretty consistently. And I felt like, you know, if I hit all of those, I could tell almost, you know, every single deer that was on the place, because they're going to emerge somewhere. And when they emerge, you know, I've got a camera and a little pile of corn there to grab their attention and get a picture of them. And I think the key to that, and this is, we're getting sidelined, but really quick, the, you know, some people will run in states where it's legal, they'll run bait in front of the camera, but they'll use so much of it that they change the behavior of the deer. You know, so then they're like, oh, I didn't see anything there for 4, 5, 6 days. And all of a sudden he was there every day. Well, that's because he's there eating your corn. You know, he doesn't live there. So you got to be careful when you're doing it that way. You got to keep everything kind of quick and small. You know, don't put out a bunch of stuff and don't leave it for a long time, because if you do, you're going to get pictures of them. But, you know, when the season comes and you're not actually hunting over corn piles anymore, he's not going to still be there. So you've got to move fairly quickly and keep your footprint, you know, a little bit small. And I just use the corn as just simply a way to concentrate the deer in front of the camera for a picture. Mock scrapes, you know, would be another option for that too. But you've got to do something in order to make it so that you're not just waiting for a deer to randomly walk past your camera.
Yeah. You know, we live in a bait state, so our world's a little bit different, you know, and every 20 acres has a feeder on it. So, you know, these deer are ridiculous. But you mentioned a mock scrape there. Is that I'm assuming that a deer won't shift his core just to go check a mock scrape. So if you are trying to circumvent that problem, is the mock scrape thing a good tactic for that?
Yeah, I think it's better than bait from that standpoint. You just don't get the inventory as quickly, because they aren't, I mean, they want that corn. I mean, you pour that pile of corn out, even on the edge of a standing cornfield, they're going to go to that pile of corn. It's just so much easier for them. So you're going to get whatever's nearby, say within a couple hundred yards, within a couple of days, you're going to have pictures of them on a camera that's sitting over a corn pile. But if you put a camera over a scrape, I mean, it's not nearly as attractive. That deer has to walk past there. You know, he's not going to smell it and come. You know, it, people think that there's something magic about it, but I mean, there's a lot of regular scrapes. You know, that mock scrape is just, you know, another scrape to them. So you might have to wait a little bit longer in order to get a picture, you know, of everything in that area. The only thing, you know, you don't get raccoons and you don't get, you know, squirrels and stuff stealing your corn, but you also don't get the pictures, you know, quite as quickly as you would if you were concentrating those deer with bait.
So you have given props to Mark Drury a few times on the show so far. Is, you know, Mark seems to think, from what I understand, and we've had him on and talked about this before, but that an annual pattern would be, a lot of times, you know, and you said that different deer have different characteristics, and I think most people would agree, but that a lot of times that a deer will have such a close annual pattern that if you saw him show up on your property on November 1st last year, that you should probably be sitting in a stand on Halloween or in for the next couple of days. I mean, you know, it's almost like within 24 hours, I've heard him say before. So, have you noticed that, or is there a little more play in that, or what do you see there?
I'm trying to think back if I could draw that conclusion or not. I know that their fall ranges tend to be the same every year unless they move their core. You know, like we talked about, some deer just literally move a quarter of a mile, you know, and then everything else changes too. But, you know, like let's say the deer is gone all summer and you never see them all summer. And then you think, well, the deer doesn't live here anymore, but then he pops in there in October. Well, you know, it's, you are now in his fall range. They have a summer range and a fall range, and some deer, they overlap. Some deer barely move from summer to fall, but others will move, you know, a mile and a half. And there was some studies done on this, that the average range shift is about a half a mile between summer and fall on average, you know, so let's say, you think, well, he shows up here at this time every year. Well, that's because that's when his fall range, you know, when he starts settling fully into his fall range. I don't know, you know, that I don't think that's, I don't know. I hate to disagree with Mark because, like I said, he knows a lot, but there's too many random behavioral influencers. Like, you know, a doe comes into estrus 1 year and, you know, the buck is there on the 1st of November because there's a hot doe there. And then he's not going to be there the next year on the 1st of November because that hot doe may not be there. So I feel like, you know, I feel like his fall range is the same. If you found him in this general area last fall, he's going to be in that same, probably that same general area this fall. You know, I feel like that's predictable, but, you know, to predict it down to the day, I don't know that I could draw that conclusion. I'd have to think about my experiences more to see if that makes sense. But just off the top of my head, I don't think I could. But I could draw a circle and say he's probably going to be in this circle every year during that time.
Yeah. Would that depend on like a cold front or something like that maybe? Or
yeah, it could be. It could be the fact that he was just more active, you know, within his fall range, you know, at certain times. You know, I feel like there are definitely some prime days, you know, so
the 7th,
you know, you might say,
don't you love November 7th?
Yeah, I really do. And then the other thing I'm really starting to gain more appreciation for is that last cold front in October, you know, wherever that falls, whether it's the 23rd or the 28th or whatever it might be, that really kicks them into gear too. That you don't want to miss that one. That's a really prime time.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually shot a deer on the 7th, a buck last year on the 7th. So, it's not a bad day, man. And my buddy, yeah, too.
Our best buddy in Kansas, he smoked a deer on the 7th too. They shot deer the same day.
it tends to be, you know, I think it's just the way that the photo period runs, you know, with the amount of daylight. And then you have a certain number of does that are in estrus during that time. It's not so many that every buck is tied up, but it's enough to get them all excited, you know? So it's sort of the top of the ramp, and then maybe it stays level, you know, for a few days. And then you get into that lull of the rut, you know, as you get into the middle of November, then you start falling off the backside of the ramp.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
I have a question for you that's kind of specific here. If you have a deer that, you know, is on, say you've got a couple trail cameras out on a few hundred acres, and a deer shows up, say, three or four times throughout, you know, a couple of months there from about November and through November and December, he's there three or four times. Do you consider that you're close to his home range, or how do you feel about your chances killing that deer the next year?
I think that you are on the fringe somewhere. You're on the fringe of his range. I mean, my experience is if you find, I always try to find their core with the camera. And, you know, I'll find the deer at like 10:30 at night or something. It's like just about every day. Well, you think, this must be where he lives. It's not where he lives. Because if you were where he lives, you'd be finding him at 6:20 or whatever. You know, you'd be catching him right after he gets out of his bed. You're on the fringe. Even if you're catching him quite regularly, you're on the fringe of his core. You might be well within his range. You know, the range is the bigger circle that he travels, but the core is basically where he lives. Mm-hmm. I always try to find that core because that's where he's most likely to be daylight active. The closer you are to where he beds, the closer you are to finding him during the day. So I keep moving cameras even after I've found a buck until I start finding him in daylight, because you just haven't found him yet, mm-hmm. even though you're getting nighttime pictures of him. So it's the same thing there. I mean, if you're getting really sporadic pictures, and especially if they're not during the day, even if they are during the day, if you're close to where he lives, you're going to be getting almost daily pictures of him. I shouldn't say that. That's probably not fair. You would if you were on bait.
But
then he's just going to swing past her when he gets up, you know, and in the evening and grab a quick bite of your corn and then move on. You can tell that you're close to his core when you start getting a lot of daylight pictures. I just keep moving until I find that, you know, and I think that's one thing that's a little bit different maybe about what I do than what most people do is they just find the deer and they're like, oh, this is where he lives. Well, that's not necessarily. So you can look at those pictures, like the first picture you get in the evening, let's say it's 10 o'clock, he shows up on the camera. Where's the first, you know, that first picture? What direction is he coming from? That's where I'm going to move my camera. So I'm going to keep backtracking him off that first picture every evening until I'm getting into his core.
Yeah.
So you can sometimes it's off your property and you don't have any options there, you know, but if you do have the chance to follow that deer backwards, you can usually find where he's living.
Yeah. So one of the things that I really appreciate, you know, the way you put your production together with Midwest Whitetail is you really kind of let us into your mind and how you, I guess thought process these hunts, and it's really helpful. But then, sometimes you just kind of have places you like to go hunt. And one of those that's a great example is like Death Ridge, which been put to death per se. So let me take a little side note here. You got to have a DR2 on your new place. I know you probably already have that in working, you know, but Death Ridge 2 has got to be out there. But
yeah. The places that I'm going to be hunting are only ridges. That's the interesting thing. I mean, that country is like every single ridge is going to be Death Ridge.
That's right. Death Ridge 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? So, is that a situation where it just lines up to where there's a lot of bucks who are able to have a core area in a close proximity to one another?
I don't know. There is still like the mystery of this stuff that you don't quite know why certain things work. And that spot never really made sense to me as far as why it was so good. I just started hunting it just kind of on a lark. Didn't really have a lot of thought went into it. And then it's like, dang, there's a lot of big deer going through here. It's a little secondary ridge off of a larger ridge, and the larger ridge is open, you know, it's a crop area, you know, where there's plenty of food then within that larger ridge. And I think they just crisscross through those secondary ridges, you know, looking for bedded does. That's all I can figure out. And why there just happened to be multiple big shooters there over the years might just be pure luck. Mm-hmm. You know, might just be one of those things where, you know, it just was about a 3 or 4 year stretch there where there was just, you know, some really big mature deer living in that area. It might not be naturally attractive for any reason other than the fact that it was just pure luck for a few years. Mm-hmm. But the best thing about that, and the reason I like it so well, is because the bulletproof entry and exit. You know, so you can get into that thing in the morning without really bumping any deer, and excuse me, you have enough spots like that, and you're eventually going to be successful. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So do you feel as if, say you've got a buck's core area figured out, are you better off hunting the fringe of the core area with just killer access as opposed to maybe bombing into where you know he's going to be, but it being a little bit sketchy with getting in there?
Yeah, for sure. I think so. I think you're better off putting in your time if you've got time. You know, everybody's situation is a little bit different. Like, you know, for example, if it's public area, you probably have to be more aggressive in going to that core, mm-hmm. you know, quicker than maybe what I might on my farm. And also, let's say you only hunt weekends and you've got like 3 or 4 days off during the rut, for example, you probably are going to be a little bit more aggressive in that situation than I might be too. I mean, I might sit the whole season on the fringe, just waiting until he comes out, knowing that I haven't damaged anything, not taking any risk. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I was able to invest maybe 40 days, you know, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, your situation should dictate a little bit how aggressively you hunt. Mm-hmm. So that would be my advice there is don't get caught up too much in somebody else's way of doing it, because that might not make sense for your situation.
Yeah, man, that's good advice. That's something a lot of people that have been around as long as you have and been in front of as many people won't admit to. You know, a lot of guys would that do what you do would say, "What my way is the way that works," you know, and do it that way. I've heard them say yeah. that, and it's frustrating that
it works. It works on my farm, and that's exactly. the other thing too is people don't get they don't realize. And this is Don Kiske told me this one time, and again, I have a lot of respect for Don. You know, just as I do for Mark too, but. I said, Don, you got to be one of the best hunters in the country with what you're killing. He said, I'm the best hunter on this farm. Yeah. He said, I really know how to hunt this farm.
Yeah. Did Candy know he said that?
Well, maybe he didn't say it exactly like that. I better be careful how I quote him. But yeah. the point was that he's really good at hunting his farm.
Yeah.
And he didn't step out so far as to say that, you know, I could have the same level of success anywhere that mm-hmm. I go. You know, so I think that's the key to it too. You know, I got really good at hunting my farm. And almost to the point where I wouldn't say it took the challenge out of it, but if let's say I got pictures of a certain buck in a certain area, I knew where I could kill that deer. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have to really put, you know, pencil to paper anymore. I'd hunted it for 18 years. You know, I knew that if I'm just patient enough and I put my time in, he's eventually going to come through this funnel. You know, I've got the access that works for me. The wind advantage will be mine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of not screwing it up yeah. at that point. So that's, I think there's, it's nice to have fresh places to hunt occasionally so that you don't get into that rut, you know, where you almost get, you know, too comfortable hunting one piece of property.
Yeah. That's about to change, for you, you know, you're definitely
yeah.
taking on something new this year. Is that, you know, what's the plan this year? Do you have any goals or, you know, does this change the way Midwest Whitetail will be producing content and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it will for sure, because I won't have access to the property out my back door. Mm-hmm. You know, I hunted on a typical year for the past 13 years of producing Midwest Whitetail. I think I averaged about 40 to 45 days a year. And they weren't all morning and evening, but some of them, a lot of them were. So let's say I averaged maybe 70 sits in a season. I mean, I'm not going to be anywhere near that. You know, I don't know what my number is going to be this year, but you know, it's not going to be 70 sits, you know, cause I don't have access to the places and they're not out my back door now. And you know, it's just the real world, I guess. I'll be hunting less, and the other guys on the show will have to carry the content a little bit more.
Mount Drake. Get it done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So no, I think that's right. Drake is going to get a lot more, time in front of the camera, and we'll find people to replace, you know, my content. And it's a natural progression. It has to happen. You know, I've told our sponsors, you know, I can't do this forever. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's just not realistic. So, you know, I need to start phasing out anyway. and let these younger guys.
Bill. I disagree.
You can be everyone on the staff at arm wrestling. I know, Bill. I know.
Well, I appreciate that, but they're all really good hunters. They're good hunters too. So it's not like they don't need me anymore. I'm the guy on the rocking chair on the porch. I might be the guy with the fly rod in his hand on October 20th.
There you go.
But put it this way. Here's another thing that people don't realize. Is that I used to hunt, I hunted everywhere. I mean, I used to hunt Newfoundland. I used to hunt Mexico, Canada, all over Canada. I think I hunted whitetail in maybe 20 different states in like 4 or 5 Canadian provinces before I started Midwest whitetail. After that, I only hunted Iowa, only hunted our farm because I had to be there in order to produce the content, and it wasn't a bad decision because the kids were young and it was awesome. I mean, I was at home doing everything that I wanted to do, and I wasn't all over the place. You know, I could be there for all their events, but I didn't get out like I used to. I got into this business because of a thirst for adventure. You know, I'm not saying I don't love whitetail hunting, but I don't want to be so one-dimensional that I never go mule deer hunting or elk hunting or, you know, I'm still young enough that I could even maybe pull off a sheep hunt once in my life.
There you go.
I want to get back to the traveling, more adventure aspect of it before it's too late. Mm-hmm. I still love whitetail and I'll still do plenty of it. And it's just a matter of, I got so one-dimensional. And I never got burned out on it. People think, oh, you must've got sick of it. I never did. But it's time for me to fringe back out and stretch my wings a little bit again.
So, Gunnison Black Canyon 2021 with us, are you going?
Yeah, I would do it. You know, and actually I fished there. Because you guys caught it right. We went, shortly after you guys went and it really wasn't very good. The river was up and we went down that SOP draw got all beat up and skinned up, and our kids, Drew and Jordan went with me, and it was a great adventure, but the fishing wasn't very good. But I came back again. We had to be out there for a wedding sometime in mid-September. Then I floated the lower part of the Gunnison and did really, really well. That was really good, but it was just a question of timing. I mean, the canyon wasn't good when we were there, but it was a great adventure.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Sure is. Yeah. So I got to ask you, since you mentioned all the adventure you've done so far, is Iowa the best place in the world to hunt whitetail deer?
Well, I mean, I think it is. I don't know about the world. Here's the question. Like somebody said, where's the best place? I said, okay, if my life depended on killing a Boone and Crockett buck, like my life depended on it, I would be someplace probably maybe in Canada, maybe Alberta, maybe Saskatchewan, and I'd be flying, I'd be flying an airplane and I'd be finding those deer. Because you got more crown land, you got more access to more ground, so if you're really serious about like, where would you kill that deer? Or where would you find that deer if your life depended on it? It probably wouldn't be Iowa, because it's so restricted on the access to land. It's just hard to get in. It's hard to find that perfect place because you just don't, you can't knock on that many doors anymore. But if I was just going to say, okay, I got to kill a Pope and Young buck to save my life, it'd probably be Texas. So I think you could probably, there's so many of them down there that 127, it's like every ranch and you can pour out a pile of corn and every ranch has got, six or seven of them that are going to make 125. I feel like your odds are better in Texas of killing a Pope and Young buck than almost anywhere. But as far as like the overall experience, I like Iowa. I mean, Kansas is really good too. I've hunted there a fair amount. I just like the Midwest because, I'm a Midwestern kid. Yeah. I'm sure there's places in Montana, places in Wyoming, there's places where little pockets here and there that are better than anything I've ever hunted. But across the boards, on average, I know so many people in Iowa that did kill big deer, just kids, like 17-year-old kids got, $4 over 160 already, or whatever, it's really good. And I don't think it's going to get worse. I think it's going to continue to get better. It's gotten better in my lifetime. And I think it will continue to get better. There's a lot of good areas, but it's really hard to beat, you know, this part of the country for sure.
Man, it was fun being up there last year. You know, I had a tag last year for Unit 5. It was pretty fun. I can definitely attest to that. What's the best place for people to find Chasing November, which is literally my favorite series on YouTube, and keep up with you this year and what you got going on?
Well, the Chasing November, the first 12 episodes did release onto the Realtree 365 app. So if you pull, you go into any app store and you get Realtree 365, the Chasing November first 12 have already released there. And then the full 24 series will release, I believe, Monday on our YouTube channel and the MidwestWhitetail.com website. But that's, Josh Sparks is the one that's producing that. And we're literally, I sent him the voiceovers for 22 and 23 yesterday evening. And, so it's an ongoing, it's a lot of work. People don't realize how much time Josh puts into that. Mm-hmm. It's a really time consuming series to produce. And cause most television series are like 13 episodes and they repeat them. Well, some guys will spend months and months to produce 13 episodes. Well, he's producing 24 originals and, he has to do it, after the hunting season ends, because we don't have the storylines, to start with until then. Mm-hmm. It's a big project. So we still haven't done the voiceover for 24 yet. I got to get with Josh. So, we got a couple more days, he'll edit it and then he'll send me, kind of the raw parts, how do we tie this story to this story? How do we keep, connect the various parts of this episode? So then I'll sit down and I'll create the voiceovers to connect all the pieces. And then that's how these things are put together.
Mm-hmm. I know you want to be the rocking chair guy, but your narrations are top notch. Yeah. Please never stop being the narrator. Okay. It's so good, man.
It's hard. It's way harder than people think.
People think
you're just sitting there talking and it's like, cause I have to do each one. I'm sure Josh gets like so sick of it, listening to my, cause I'll do each line like six times, trying the different inflections, trying to figure out, okay, how do I put the correct feeling into this? And I'll listen to it later when he drops it in there. I'm like, oh gosh, that sounds bad. It's really hard. It's really hard to do voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
I can appreciate that art where I never would have been able to if we hadn't done this project. Just because you don't know which words to hit. It's like you try it a certain way and then you try it another way and then you try it another way. And, then the one he ends up using is, probably the best one that he thought was there. And you listen to it and you think, gosh, I missed that one.
Yeah.
Because it's not like we're just talking, it's easier when you're just talking, but when you're sitting there and you've written up a script and now you're reading the script into a voice recorder, it's not the same. You don't naturally hit the right words.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree, man. I've done it before. It's difficult, but anyway, Bill, I can't tell you how much, we enjoy talking to you, man. It's just always a good conversation. And there's also just so much to be learned, man. You've had some great experiences with a ton of deer and some big deer over the years. And so it's hard to beat Bill Winky for, good information on how to get in close to big bucks. I think you said that you're the best, probably the best hunter on your old farm, and you may not have said that, but that's kind of what I inferred from it. So, but I think that you probably have a lot of experience that can relate to a lot of people, and I appreciate you doing this, Bill.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun and thank you guys, for including me.
Sure. Yeah. All right, man. Well, we appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good fall.
Awesome. You too. Good luck.
Good stuff right there from Bill. He always has just a cool angle on things, and that's a big thing for me, even as a public land hunter, to see you have to be creative sometimes. And, one way that we have been able to kind of hopefully help some people is showing some of our creative strategies and what we look for with the hot public land hotspots. That's a hard thing to say.
Hot public land hotspots. They're hot. That's what we just.
I mean, they're
we should
so
throw
hot.
Extra hot in there.
Yeah, I mean, we're in Texas in the summer eating jalapenos. You know what I mean? So it's hot. But anyway, that there's a hotspot video that's releasing on Thursday this week, and we've already released two. And so these are the one we're releasing this week is called Staging Dead Spots, and KC is going to make me explain this. But anyway, so the idea is this. that basically you've got a destination food source, right? And then you've got like brush that'll hold deer. And these two spots are far enough away that there can't be any bedding in between the, like they're essentially in between the, what would you assume is would be bedding is basically grazed cattle stuff. So it can't be that there's brush there, because mm-hmm. if there's brush right beside the field, it's likely that there are does bedding right next to the ag field, especially the later in the season you get. And so it, that considered, you know, that there's no pressure maybe, or not much pressure. So anyway, like creating this big dead spot allows there to be a, like, for instance, if the deer are bedding super close, they cannot, or they can essentially get to that food source after dark and not have to stand up until it's too dark to shoot. So if you have this big dead spot cattle pasture in between where they have to bed and where they are going to eat, then you've got deer that have to get up on their feet, or in theory have to get up on their feet earlier to get to go a half mile or whatever it might be to get to that spot. So you're able to assume essentially using this spot that deer are going to be on their feet in the daylight. And that's the key theory. So I don't know if I do a very good job of explaining that in the video. So just take that, go watch the video, and now you'll understand it better. You know,
perfect.
So, but anyway, it's something to look for. So if you trust us, you know, look for a staging dead spot, even if you don't understand it. I do explain what that kind of looks like. I just don't explain that the reason
it
that,
helps with the map integration.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, explaining the fact that you're looking for deer with that are on their feet in daylight is kind of the main theory there. So anyway, go check that out. The Map Scout Challenge from this week was Lake Whitney here in Texas.
Oh yeah.
Which is a few hours away. KC thought that was a really cool place. That was the first Map Scout Challenge we did, so it's very long.
Yeah, and it's also, you can tell we're kind of figuring out how the Map Scout Challenge goes yeah. in this video, but I think that's kind of a fun process to see, too, you know, yeah. after going all over the country doing it, you know, kind of looking back at our home state one that we started out with.
Yeah. People seem to like it. I mean, our friend Micah was like, man, this is some good, helpful stuff.
Yeah,
so,
there's been a lot of the – you know what's interesting? Is we did the first video we released was Kentucky, and people were like, "Oh, you gave away a good all the secret spots."
Yeah, I know.
You know, and ever since then, like guys be like, "I hunt right there. This is awesome video, guys." You know,
know.
It's like I don't know what you Kentucky boys are drinking in that water over there, but just be nice. No, most of y'all are nice. Just a couple guys were just like, "I can't believe you gave away that spot." It's like, well, we just. It's on the map.
I kind of wonder if there wasn't like a single person creating a bunch of accounts to troll. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was weird because we haven't had any of that happen since.
No,
but somebody
since.
In Kentucky got mad and was like, just kept saying, "I'm on a hunt right there," you know, or whatever. It's like, well, so does everybody else, I think. So, you know, sorry you didn't have it to yourself before, but you don't have it to yourself now either. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It probably ain't enough people watching it to affect them anyway. But, you know, these have been, I think, helpful for some people, and that's kind of our main goal, man, is we've had a lot of people reach out, and we've noticed a lot of people in some of these Facebook groups and stuff that are really just needing some help and some guidance that are mm-hmm. getting into hunting and stuff, and COVID has really turned people to that. In one way, it makes it hard on us to kill deer, maybe, when you got a ton of pressure and people crawling over the place, which is probably what's going to happen in Colorado.
And Kentucky,
apparently. But in another sense, you know, like we've got bigger numbers. We're going to have bigger license sales, more money coming into, you know, conservation and just keeping lands public and all these other things that we would value. And maybe even buying new properties to have more, you know, spots for hunters. And so, and we just have a better political influence if we have more hunters, right? So there's good and bad. I think the good outweighs the bad. And so we just kind of have to deal with some people this year, and who knows what happens next year. There may not be as many people in the woods,
yeah.
But
hey, instead of know, dealing with them, help them, you know, yeah. And that's what you and I have both been trying to do on Facebook some, you mm-hmm. know? So,
yep.
If you're new to this stuff, guys, reach out to us, you know, we'll help you whatever way we can. And that's kind of why we did the Map Scout Challenge stuff too, you know, mm-hmm. Not just for guys who are trying to find that extra edge, but also guys who are just trying to figure out how to go, where to go.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, you know, our ideas were that we were going to go try to find deer in spots and if we find deer sign in a spot, then that could be a good spot to hunt. And
you know, I don't know how many people you might meet there, but if you're a new hunter that doesn't have a clue and you want to go try it, it ain't going to hurt our feelings. I can tell you that.
Here's like the catch 22 of these Map Scout Challenge locations. There's a chance that no one shows up and actually hunts the coordinate that we give away, mm-hmm. because everyone's like, oh, everybody's going to go there. So what if you're that guy who yeah. goes to Southern Missouri and goes and hunts a 155-inch 10-point because you're the only person who actually goes?
I know. It's scary, dude. It's scary to think about, dude.
It is.
And now 10,000 people are heading that way.
I know, golly. No.
Anyway, so we hope that stuff is good for you, man. And we appreciate you listening. Hope you found some good information from Bill. I know I certainly did. And the reason we had him on, as we do a lot of our guests, is kind of selfish. We're looking at, you know, targeting a few deer this year and how we can do that better. And Bill is a good guy to have on to help us do that, because he has consistent success and proven resume in that field. So with that said, guys, remember to go check out all the links. And remember, this is your element.
Living it.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate Batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate Batteries. I use Interstate Batteries in my boats. I use Interstate Batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.